You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Bob Schieffer had been the moderator of CBS's Face the Nation for almost 3 years when Richard Nixon died in April 1994. The roundtable discussion that Sunday morning included several of Nixon's former aides reminiscing about Nixon's time in office, but Mr. Schieffer felt the show required a few more words to put the former president's life and career in context, so he added some final thoughts at the end of the broadcast. Over the next 2 weeks, that commentary generated more letters than anything on the show till then. And 14 years later, those editorial insights have become a regular part of the program. Mr. Schieffer has collected some of them, along with commentaries and new material, in a book he's called Bob Schieffer's America. It's published by Putnam, and I'm pleased that it brings Bob Schieffer back to the show today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard.
We're going to start off with a song called TV Anchorman. I don't know what happened, but that's a song that was written and sung by you.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a fun thing we do. A friend of mine has a band, and for some occasion, well, it was a roast, a spinal bifida roast in Washington, and you just sort of be part of the roast. I wrote this song about a guy who's working in a gas station, and a guy pulls up in a red Corvette and thinks he has a serious-looking face and makes him a TV anchorman. And I have some lines in the song. One of the lines is, they wrote me some lines and taught me a style, drew a happy face on the script where I should smile, and the key demographics went right off the chart. That's actually based on a true story. A friend of mine swears he worked at a station where the anchor person was so dumb that they wrote a happy face on the top of the script when he was supposed to smile and a sad face when he was supposed to frown.
Oh, there was
so
that.
It's a joke.
There was that movie with Will Ferrell where
yeah.
he was Ron Burgundy, and he read whatever you put on the teleprompter,
yeah.
even if it was something he shouldn't say.
Exactly.
But you have a band called Honky Tonk Confidential. Will you pursue a musical career after you have retired from broadcasting?
Short answer, no. But, you know, we have a lot of fun with it. We're going to have a book party in New York here Friday night, and the band's going to be there, and I'm going to sing a couple of numbers.
Well, maybe they'll play a little bit from TV Anchorman later. You've attended your 10th Republican convention and your 11th
yes.
convention with the Democrats. How did they compare with the ones that you attended in the far distant past?
You know, every one of them is different, and I always tell people that they're not like they used to be. They're not real nominating conventions anymore.
Yeah, they're infomercials.
They're more like infomercials. But my gosh, I mean, these two that we had this year, to see Senator Ted Kennedy get up there and make that speech that he made, to see Hillary Clinton after the campaign that she waged and her husband Bill, and then Barack Obama before 84,000 people. As far as I know, Leonard, that is the largest political gathering in the history of this country. And then to go to St. Paul to John McCain's convention and this unveiling of Sarah Palin, it was an unbelievable thing, and the way she captured that convention. Now, I don't know how she's going to play in the general election with Democrats and with independents, but I'll tell you one thing. The Republicans who didn't like John McCain, that side of the Republican Party, and believe me, there are a lot of them, they now love it.
For picking her.
Yes. There's just no question about that. We have a CBS News poll that was out yesterday, and it showed that going into the convention, only 24% of the Republicans were enthusiastic about John McCain. That doubled to about 42%.
But you've been covering a lot of conventions, and isn't there always a post-convention bounce?
I don't think we've had an enthusiasm bounce like that. I mean, there's no question that she changed the game. John McCain, the old fighter pilot, puts it up on the line, you know, takes the big risk. She made a tremendous first impression, and as of now, you got to say John McCain must have played it right politically. Now, how long is this going to last? How does she wear as we get into the campaign? We're going to find out, but she's off to a great start. I'll give him that.
Because it's almost 2 months till the election.
Yeah.
Your first convention was in 1968, and in your post-convention final thoughts, you said that was the most memorable, not because it was your first.
No, but because exactly 9 months to the day after that convention, our first daughter was born. We thought we weren't going to have any
kids. That must have been a hot convention.
It was something. And my daughter was in high school, and she kind of finally figured it out. And one day she said to her mom, well, I guess it wasn't all fighting in the streets out there in Chicago. But Leonard, the great and loving thing about that is that we went back to Chicago in 96, I guess it was, when it was the first time Democrats had gone back to Chicago since that awful convention. And that daughter met the guy at that convention that she married. It's now her husband and father of her two children.
Well, these are good reasons to keep on going to conventions.
Absolutely.
You say in the book that you were raised a Democrat, but you've been an independent for years. Do you think that most of the people in your business have become independents because
a lot of them have the requirements of the
job?
And a lot of them don't vote. They think it's a way to maintain their impartiality. Now, I don't do that. I love to vote. I never tell anybody who I voted for. I don't even tell my wife because she, you know, she's I'm afraid she'd think I disappointed her. But I love to vote. It's one of the favorite things that I do.
And there are many people in this business, in NPR, who feel that you should not be registered with a political party mm-hmm. because it's a matter of public record, mm-hmm. that you should never go to a rally, that you should never go on a peace march or any kind of political protest, never attend as a private citizen because it muddies your image.
Well, I really do think that a journalist, if he wants to maintain some objectivity, should not take part in partisan activities. I mean, I really think it's pretty hard to maintain objectivity and do that. But I think citizenship requires that we all vote if we can. And, you know, I read history and I find that, you know, Hitler actually came to power in an election. You know, they voted him in.
Although he was a minority winner. Later he effected a power coup.
But I would always like to think that if I'd have known about it and known who he was, I would love to have voted against him. And
I'm sure you would have. The conventions really are aimed at the independents, mm-hmm. aren't they? Do you think that one party made a better case with the independents than the other?
Well, it's really hard to say, and I'm not sure I could make a judgment on it on that right now. I think this was a convention that John McCain had to come out of it with Republicans united behind him. I think that was first step because they really weren't. John McCain sort of backed into this nomination when you come right down to it. There were a lot of Republicans that were very uneasy about it, especially the social conservatives. He somehow, with his pick of Governor Palin, at this point has won over the social conservatives. I mean, at least I would say that's what the evidence would be if you judged the reaction at the convention.
And he was on your show, Face mm-hmm. the Nation, this past Sunday, again talking a lot about Sarah Palin. He said, with all due respect to any critic, I think being mayor is a very important job nowadays, especially the way America is hurting. That didn't work well for Rudy Giuliani.
No, it didn't. And I think the jury is still out on I mean, it seems to me that it's very difficult to argue that Barack Obama is not qualified to be president and then turn around and say that Sarah Palin is. Charles Krauthammer, the very conservative columnist, said when he appointed Sarah Palin to be his running mate that the experience argument against Barack Obama simply evaporated. Now, I'm quoting him. We're going to find out about it.
Well, that's why they're going after Barack Obama as a community organizer to try to undermine that.
Which I think a lot of people had some real questions about that, and I pressed Senator McCain on that. I said, you know, in your speech to the convention, you talked about if you don't like the way things are, try to do something about it. Enlist in the military. Help feed the hungry. Teach. And I said, so what is it that's wrong with being a community organizer? And Senator McCain said there's absolutely nothing wrong. Now, he said that he thought that Sarah Palin used that line about community organizers because the Obama people had sort of denigrated the fact she was a small-time mayor. But I'll tell you something. I've known John McCain for 20 years. He was not comfortable with that. He was not comfortable with that. And he said, and I said, so you're saying nothing negative. He said, there's nothing negative. It's to be commended that he was a community organizer.
Now, when you say you've known him for 20 years, I've read that you used to socialize with him. Maybe you still do. And it's often pointed out that Senator McCain has been a darling of the press in the past because he seemed to develop a very good rapport with journalists. Do those sorts of personal connections make it harder to be objective with a politician?
I think you have to be very careful about it. And when you say I've socialized with him, I was at the dinner 4 years ago at the Republican convention in New York when he had kind of a dinner for the media. And a lot of us that had covered him over the years were there for that. I don't basically run around with John McCain, but I have done things with John McCain, like go to Walter Reed Army Hospital when there was no press there, when he wanted no publicity. He invited me one time. He said, you know, you really ought to come out to Walter Reed and see what's happening out there and visit with some of these guys. I did. I made my first visit out there with him, and because of that, I kept going back. But no, we don't play golf together or anything like that. Well, he doesn't play golf, but it's not that kind of a social relationship. Well, but I've covered him for a long, long time.
I'm not near as important as you, but I've been wooed by some politicians, and first I was complimented, and then I thought, wait a minute, I understand what this is all about. And
let me tell you something, Leonard, and what you
learn.
It's
like taking a free meal, you know.
What you learn after you've been around for a while, politicians don't cultivate you because you've got a nice personality or they think you're cute or something. They do because you work where you work. I'll never forget my first job at a little radio station in Fort Worth, and the news director told me one time, said, call the mayor and see what he thinks about that. And I said, well, I can't call the mayor. He said, call the mayor and find out what he thinks about this. And so I called the mayor. His wife answered the phone, and I said, this is Bob Schieffer at KXOL. I said, I need to speak to the mayor. She said, honey, Bob Schieffer's on the line. So, you know, I was a 20-year-old kid. That's what being a reporter is all about. But you always have to remember, it's who you work for and what you can do for them. That's why they return the calls.
You pressed Senator McCain on the economy, and he told you that Americans are hurting in a way that they haven't hurt for a long time. That of the 65 appearances he had made on your show, this time the economy was at its worst. And you reminded him that he had said that the economy was fundamentally sound. How much can you press a politician these days? The McCain campaign has punished CNN because they felt a reporter had pressed somebody too hard. And everybody seems to be complaining out of that. I'm sure Barack Obama has also been complaining about his coverage, but they've been complaining about the way Sarah Palin's personal life mm-hmm. has been covered. One of the Republican officials said that he felt the Democrats and the press had crossed the line. So is it different if you're working for the big three networks or one of the cable news services? Can you do something different there?
My feeling on that is that if they want to say something about the press in general, that's fine. But to me, it's a one-on-one deal. If they're going to punish me, I want it to be about something that I did. And I think, generally speaking, that's the way it is. I think each news organization, each reporter works as sources. I've never found any politician that was too worried about my ideology, whatever that is. They're worried about whether I'm going to give them a fair shot. But let me just say something, Leonard, about this coverage of Governor Palin. There was some pretty rough stuff said out there, but it was not said by the mainstream media. A lot of this stuff that cropped up on these blogs, we'd never touched that stuff. We had to check it out. But you shouldn't criticize us for the questions we ask. Criticize us for what we put on television, what we put in the newspapers, because a lot of times these blogs, I mean, this is right there on the credibility level of some guy standing on the street holding a sign up that says the end is near. This is people out there venting. That's not journalism.
In fact, I received many emails with a list of books that Sarah Palin was supposed to have asked the librarian in her mm-hmm. town to censor, and it's a hoax. But I'm sure that that list has been passed out all over America.
But you
America.
Never saw that on – heard that on CBS, and I don't
no,
think
but,
you
but
saw
it. No, but there is a complaint that – and this is across the board – that you can do something like a swift boat or the equivalent, yeah. and the press has to cover it, and then it winds up being legitimized simply because it's out there and the press has reported on it.
But we never touched this business about this child that the internet was going nuts about. This was not really the child's child. It was
or hers, it wasn't because her they showed child. Pictures it of her the, not looking
and,
pregnant.
And all of that. We did, but you have to ask questions. You have to go find out if it's true. That's what we're supposed to do. But
that's what happened to Bill Clinton, isn't it?
Yeah. We live in this blogosphere now where stuff that never used to get, you know, we used to have whispering campaigns and all of that, but the stuff didn't get on the air. It didn't get in the newspapers. Now everything's out there. But again, I go back to this. These blogs, for some people, are mental health devices. I mean, they don't have anything to do with journalism. they're for venting and all that. So
I'm talking with Bob Schieffer, whose latest book is forth, Is Bob Schieffer's America? It's published by Putnam. We will continue our conversation after this.
Well, I left this job that I just took, started practicing my sincere look. They said I had the face of a man with heart. They wrote me some lines, taught me a style, drew a happy face on the script where I should smile, and the key demographics went right off the chart. I have to say they pay me good, a whole lot better than Stuckey's ever would, and a cute little stage manager gives me all my cues. Selling tractor hats and pumping gas, that's all part of my long ago past. Now I just sit there and read the news.
He became a TV anchorman.
A TV anchorman.
He joined the eyewitness team.
And Channel 4, Channel
Bob Schieffer, I guess he doesn't have enough to do. He anchors a Sunday news show, he writes books, and he writes and sings songs. And that was quite credible. I'm sorry,
oh,
Bob.
Well, thank
that was
you.
Pretty good.
I like it.
Well, I mean, I've heard
my boss Sean McManus.
I used to be in the record
CBS
business.
He's not quite as pleased with it as I am. But
really, why?
he gives me a lot of ribbing on it.
But I used to be in the country music business, and
really,
and that was quite credible.
Thank you.
One of several subjects that you've returned to over the years is campaign finance reform. And some of John McCain's 65 appearances on your show must have been with respect to that issue. Do you think any progress has been made since McCain-Feingold?
Well, if bailing out the ocean with a bucket, if you could say that was progress, we've made several buckets full of progress, I guess. But it's such an enormous and complicated thing that I'd have to say that actually we haven't made very much
progress. It's almost like the tax code. No matter what you write, somebody's going to find a way to get around it.
It's even harder to write campaign laws than it is to write income tax laws because nobody can be objective about it. You know, I mean, these are laws written by the people who will be regulated by them. The Congress writes the laws and then has to live by them and so forth. So it's very, very difficult. But, you know, we are going to have this time, Leonard, our first $2 billion presidential campaign. Last year, 4 years ago, the whole campaign, everything, Congress, Senate, and all that, $1 billion. We're going to pass $2 billion. We passed $1 billion before we got to the presidential conventions.
Well, part of the problem is the way that primaries are run, and you've complained about that. But do you think we should return to the old days where—
I would love to see us—
The party bosses got together, and they often came up with the best candidate.
Well, that's the thing. You know, we always said the smoke-filled room and all of that, and we went to the primary system to give more people a voice. But what we really did was just give people with money more of a voice. And I think we do need to just sort of examine this whole thing. I tell you, another thing I think we have to do is find out some way to fairly draw the lines for congressional districts. Finding a way to put limits on this money and redrawing those lines. Maybe go to something, you know, have retired judges or somebody like they do in Australia. They draw the lines and then the Congress votes on the whole thing up or down, like we vote on whether or not to close military bases. But what we have here is this incumbent protection society. You keep my district like it is, I'll keep yours like it is. It crosses all party lines, and it's designed to keep the incumbents in power. We need more of a turnover in the Congress.
And it's almost as old as the electoral system, gerrymandering.
Yeah.
I understand it's gerrymandering, not gerrymandering, which they taught me in school.
Yeah.
But I guess it's a tradition that people don't want to give up.
It's the kind of thing that people don't think about. You know, how your congressional district is drawn is not something you wake up in the morning thinking of and worrying about. You're thinking about putting some bread on the table.
Until Tom DeLay causes a sensation in Texas.
So it's hard to build public support for it, but it's very, very important.
Another theme in your final thoughts is the increasingly partisan nature of politics in Washington. You write, as I've watched Washington from within for nearly four decades, I've seen it become meaner, more partisan, less productive. But here's the good news. The founders devised a system so ingenious that even the most incompetent who have come here have never been able to damage it beyond repair. Now, the Democrats claim that the Republicans created the situation when they took over Congress under the leadership of Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay. Is that a fair accusation?
No. I think everybody's responsible. I think both parties are responsible. I think the news media is responsible. It's a problem that really needs to be fixed, and it's going to take both parties to do it. But will they think it's important enough, and will they think it's in each of their interests enough to do it? That's the secret.
The news media are responsible because they act as provocateurs. They like the narrative of these politicians going at each other's throats.
I just think we're not serious enough about it. And too often, we carry water for both sides on this because we enjoy seeing the fight.
And both candidates have campaigned on the idea of making Washington less partisan. Barack Obama has made it one of his themes, and John McCain said something along those lines in his acceptance speech. Do you think that they're just saying something that the voters want to hear, or do you think that it is possible?
Who knows? But, McCain swears that he is going to change it. He says, I'm going to change it. He says, I'm going to put more Democrats in the cabinet. He said, one is just having a token Democrat is not enough. He says he's going to put Democrats on his White House staff. We will see what we will see. Barack Obama, of course, is running on the whole idea of change. I tell you something. I think that the American people are ready to turn a page here. Whether they want to turn the page by, electing Barack Obama, or whether they want to turn the page by electing a guy who says, I'm the maverick and I'm not like the people who've been in office for the past 8 years.
Running against my own party.
Even though they are my party. I mean, that was a very interesting convention, the Republican convention, Leonard, because it was basically an anti-Bush convention. I mean, I think his name was mentioned one time.
And I wondered about that because I would assume that a fair number of the delegates are among that percentage of America who are strongly in support of George Bush.
Well, when George Bush spoke early on by satellite to the convention, he got a tremendous round of applause, but you never heard another word about him. And when John McCain made his acceptance speech, he did not mention his name. He referred to him as the president. And that was that.
My guest is Bob Schieffer. He's written a book called Bob Schieffer is America. It is published by Putnam. Actually, this is your fourth book.
Yes.
And I've heard that somewhere along the line you would love to write a novel. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The problem with writing fiction is people think everything that comes out of Washington is fiction.
Exactly. I mean, the problem with trying to write a novel about Washington right now is you can't make up what's going on right now.
You're moderating the third and fourth presidential debates. That's the final one, right, at Hofstra. Some of those debates have become issues in themselves because people have felt that the moderators have asked gotcha questions and actually repeated some of the political accusations against candidates on both sides. Mm-hmm. How do you avoid doing that sort of thing and still maintaining your integrity as a journalist?
Well, I think you have to look on these. These should be about issues. These are not about personalities. They shouldn't be about political tactics and all of that. This is the last place that you can get the candidates on the records about issues. And let me just tell you, Leonard, they're going to be great this year because we're going to have a new format. The candidates have agreed to ask each other follow-up questions. We're going to divide each debate into nine-minute segments. I'll be responsible in that third debate, which is going to be on domestic policy. It'll be my responsibility to decide what each of those segments is about. I'll ask one question to the two of them, and then they'll just have out at it. And I mean, if it works like we hope it'll work, I won't say another word until it's time to say, okay, time's up, let's go on to something else. Mm-hmm. If they don't ask hard follow-up questions or get off the mark, I'll interrupt and say, well, let me ask this. But it's going to be, we hope that we'll finally have a real debate, not some sort of joint news conference where I ask each of them questions. I think if it works, it's going to be very enlightening.
Well, we've seen debates look uneven in the past mm-hmm. because some people are more effective than yeah. others, but it doesn't always translate into votes. John McCain is not as comfortable a speaker as Barack Obama.
John McCain, I think, is not as good a speaker making a set speech.
Reading from a teleprompter.
But I think that John McCain, who's been in the Senate for a long, long time, knows how to hold his own in a debate, or especially when he's asked a hostile question. Now, will he blow his stack? I think he won't, but a lot of people will be watching for that. It's going to be very interesting to see both of them sort of off script here in one at one time at one place.
In this book, you had to sift through 700 of your final thought mm-hmm. pieces over the years. You wound up with 171, and you broke them up into different categories: mm-hmm. human interest, obituaries, under the title "The Lives We Led." Even there, you had to sift through. You didn't do all the obituaries. So what determined what went in and what didn't?
I just picked the ones that I thought, the ones that I liked. And there were about 700. When you go over your work over a long period of time like that, you find that, in fact, a lot of it does not stand the test of time. So I thought the ones that I put in there were the ones that I thought still held up. Obits, I'm with Ronald Reagan. I love to read the obits, mainly to check every morning to see if I'm not listed there, you know. And when I'm not, I feel like it's going to be a good day. But, you know, it's a funny thing. Obits are the last place now where we find positive things. I mean, the definition, by definition, news is the bad stuff that happened, the unscheduled stuff. But in the obits, I find them very inspirational.
Because we're always hearing about people's accomplishments.
Yes. I read them religiously every day, and they're one of my favorite parts of the newspaper.
I usually read them to determine whether I'm past the demographic, you know, whether I'm
exactly.
Oh, that person died 5 years younger than me. Oh, mm-hmm. I still have 30 years to go. One of the more fun human interest stories here is the snake thief from Florida.
Yes.
And I wonder how you find some of those stories.
I don't know. I don't know where
the people
came
send
from.
Them in.
Sometimes people send them in. Sometimes there'll be some little note on the wire. That particular one meant so much to me because my mother, who was a child of the Depression, had the feeling that people will steal anything that's not nailed down. And I kind of wrote that in her memory because it was a man who was arrested for trying to steal two snakes, and he had one of them in his pocket and one of them in his belt, and he was trying to get out of the pet store, and the one that was under his belt stuck its head out from under his shirt, and that's how they arrested him. And he claimed he was just trying to return them to their cages. My mother would have loved this. She said, "See, I told you."
I was disappointed that a particular favorite of mine, the Ode to Grilled Cheese, didn't make the
cut. It did make it. It is in the book. And I said in the beginning of the book that I said I have nearly 171 essays in here. And somebody said, "How could you have nearly 171? I said, "Because the Ode to Grilled Cheese Sandwiches is only a half a commentary."
When you began these commentaries, people replied by snail mail. Uh-huh. Now they can respond almost immediately. You can get off the air and have to sift through thousands, I'm sure. Do you notice a difference between the
Oh, absolutely. A lot of times people used to write letters, and then I'm sure what happened, they'd get it out of their system, they'd wad it up and throw it in the wastebasket. Now they just press the old send button. So you get it in unvarnished terms, both good and bad.
And what happens when you get something where you think, well, you know, they were absolutely right. I shouldn't have done it that way.
Sometimes I do. I mean, these little essays are just snapshots of my thinking, and I don't always get it right. And there's some in there that I put in that I was wrong, that it didn't come out the way I thought it was going to. And I just wanted to, you know, do that to kind of flesh out the book.
When you started doing these commentaries, were the people at CBS happy?
They didn't notice. I mean, this is the audience.
Because there
thing.
Was always that feeling you and, should you know, not editorialize.
I wrote these things, and then I began to wonder, I wonder if I have permission to do this. And then I thought, well, if I don't, they'll call me and tell me not to do it. Nobody ever said a word, and then I won a National Sigma Delta Chi Award for best commentaries on television. All the bosses called and said, great work, keep it up. So it's the nature of bureaucracies.
The secret is to win an award, and then they have to accept the fact that you're doing something right. Until then, of course.
Yeah.
Is that a problem? Because CBS has gone through so many changes in management over the years, and I'm sure that you've gotten direction in this way and then direction, oh, no, don't do what that other guy told you and go in this whole other direction.
Well, none of my bosses, and people sometimes find this hard to believe, and certainly no sponsor has ever told me how to cover a story or told me what conclusion to come to. That just doesn't happen. For one thing, they know that if I didn't say on the air that they'd accused me or told me to do something, that I'd probably leak it to somebody else. I mean, nobody would do that. But what I do, when I do the commentaries, Leonard, they are clearly labeled commentary. I want people to know this is my thought. This is not a straight news story. And in a way, it's kind of disclosure. I hope it builds my credibility that when I report something that people say, I know how he feels about this.
Because that's very important. People trust you if they have a sense of who you are. And in the end, that's what made Walter Cronkite such a success, for example, or Edward R. Murrow, or Tom Brokaw, or Peter Jennings. They felt they knew these people.
It's the coin of the realm. Is your credibility, and if they believe you. Because, you know, the great governor on all of this is if they don't believe you, they won't pay any attention and they won't watch or they won't read you. And that's what makes the free press honest.
When we were owned by the city, we did get pressure at times to cover a story in a certain way.
Really?
Yeah. We had to, because the heads of the station were appointed by the mayor, mm-hmm. and one mayor, I should not mention his name, but it was his nickname was Rudy. He had a guy here who would tell me just how to approach a certain guest. Alphonse D'Amato was coming on. He wanted me to just slam the man because Rudy was having a fight with him. And my response was, wait, I have my own journalistic integrity. If you're going to try to pressure me into doing something like that, well, then eventually it will come out and you're going to look bad. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's commendable that someone at CBS has never thought of doing something like
that.
Because the public always is suspicious about it.
You know, they're too smart to pull something like that because they know just what you're saying. And if we didn't publicly say it, we'd certainly, you know, we all have friends in the media, as it were. We'd certainly let somebody else know about it. It would get out. You couldn't do it. Couldn't get away with it.
Do you just plan to keep on doing Face the Nation?
You know, I guess I am.
Ad infinitum.
I have retired and then unretired and then retired. My brother said I'm acting like Roger Clemens, and he made me promise not to get on the steroids, so I told him I would do that. But
well, you did the nightly news, and the ratings went up.
It was great. It was one of the best experiences of my life. I never wanted to do it on a long-term basis, never thought I would, and I still don't. But it worked out fine, and I really had a lot of fun doing it. So I'm going to keep doing Face the Nation, and basically until they find somebody in the next year or so to replace me. But I'm still going to work at CBS. Tom Brokaw is my guide to the golden years. I'm going to always be around. If they need me at a big event, then I'll be there.
And meanwhile, you're writing books and writing songs?
Yep.
And can we expect another book in the near future?
You know, I might. Lyndon Johnson had such an impact on me as a kid. He was the first politician I ever knew about. I saw him first when I was 11 years old, when he came to the vacant lot where we played baseball. He was running for the Senate. And he was in a helicopter, and the reason we all went down there, we'd never seen a helicopter before. So this is a big deal in the neighborhood. But, you know, from that day on, I sort of fell in love with politics. So maybe there's a Johnson book somewhere. I'm thinking about it.
Since 1969, Bob Schieffer has been at CBS News. He's covered all four major beats, the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department, and Capitol Hill. He is now CBS's chief Washington correspondent. He's written six songs and four books.
Probably six.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Leonard, it's a pleasure.